yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Jack Rasmus. The show is Alternative Visions, where we talk about solutions, not only the problems. My guest today is Art Stamoulis. Art is executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, a national coalition of labor, environmental, family, farm, and consumer organizations that is working together on questions of international trade policy. Their current focus is on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, Treaty in the Works, TPP for short. Right. Citizens Trade Campaign is organized and has organized demonstrations about in protest of the TPP and the negotiations that are going on right now, that have gone on, continuing to go on in the whole Pacific Rim. Meetings have been held in Virginia, California, Texas, Illinois, and they're kind of secret meetings. No one gets to know what these guys are talking about. Obama, of course, is pushing free trade, free trade, free trade. And we know the legacy of free trade. The legacy in the past is a loss of jobs on an immense dimension. North American Free Trade Agreement, negotiated by another Democrat president, Clinton, cost us over 3 million jobs, according to the Economic Policy Institute, since its introduction in the mid-1990s, and still causing job loss. And then, of course, we have the near-free trade-like agreements, the Preferred Nation Trading Rights with China, which has cost us another 3 million jobs since 2000. So that's over 6 million jobs. And you know, that's just about the number of jobs declined that the government indicates in its database for loss of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. In the year 2000, we had 18.5 million manufacturing jobs. Today we have 12 million, barely. So we lost about 6.5 million jobs in manufacturing. And I'm only talking about manufacturing, you know. These free trade agreements cause job losses in services, and increasingly so. In fact, there was a study a couple years ago by the economist Alan Blinder, well-known, out of Harvard, out of Princeton, I believe, and his paper indicated that we could lose another 15 million jobs in the next decade to free trade. Now, free trade is a cornerstone for the big multinational corporations. They love it. They are pushing it. And for 2 years now, who's been running the jobs program in the Obama administration? It's been CEO Jeff Immelt of General Electric, the biggest manufacturing corporation in the U.S. and probably the world. Yeah, they're running the free trade drive and the whole jobs program. And we know we're having trouble with job creation, aren't we? You know, if you look at Obama's declared successes in job creation, 5 million jobs since the low point of the recession, 2009-10, right? Well, look at the composition of those jobs. Low pay. 58% of the jobs that have been created since 2009 have been low-paid jobs. In other words, jobs that pay less than $13 an hour, between $7 and $13 an hour. And what are the jobs we've lost since 2009? Well, the high-paying jobs, jobs that pay over $18 an hour. We've lost 60%. Of the job loss since 2009 has been high-paying jobs. 58% of the jobs created since 2009 under Obama have been low-paying jobs. Low-paying means lots of those jobs are part-time temp jobs, service jobs. So we've been churning out the good jobs and replacing them with low-paying service jobs, and we continue to lose millions of jobs in manufacturing and higher-paid occupations, much of which has gone to free trade as a result of free trade. Keep that in mind. This Friday, by the way, we're going to see what the jobs numbers look like. Here's another interesting thing I've been writing about for 3 years now. Over the winter months, from November through March, we always seem to have a job surge, an increase in jobs. The job data looks good. And then when the spring, summer comes, the bottom falls out again. That's happened 3 years in a row. We've had a collapse of jobs growth in spring, summer, late spring, summer. And then we have an increase in jobs growth in the winter. Why is that? Is it just seasonality? No, I don't think so. I've been saying there's something interesting going on with the job statistics and how they adjust the raw jobs data for seasonality and how they make erroneous assumptions about the creation of new businesses, small businesses, etc. I'm not going to go into that arcane discussion now, but next week, just as a preview, I'm going to be talking about my economic predictions and for the next following 3 weeks. Every year, I make economic predictions. I write an article for Z Magazine, predictions for the forthcoming year to 2 years. This past January, I didn't do it because of the situation with the deficit cutting. It was just too uncertain. But now the picture's beginning to clear, and I will be making a statement again and talking about the U.S. economy. We'll look at jobs next week, then housing, then government and business spending, and then the global picture. It will be my prediction for 2013-14. By the way, you can read my earlier predictions, most of which have come true, from my article, Economic Predictions 2012 and 13 and Beyond, which is on my website. The website is Kyklos Productions, spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S, productions.com. KyklosProductions.com. A lot of my TV and radio interviews are there as well if you're interested. You can Google me if you forget how to spell it and just go and look for that economic predictions article. Or you can go to my blog, JackRasmus.com, all one word, and I think you can find the same article there. Okay. Before we move on to this important topic, once again, a very brief subsequent statement I need to make, as I do every show, a running commentary on what's happening with deficit spending cuts and sequestration and all fiscal cliff and all that nonsense. As you know, I predicted they would make a deal, a very small token deal on January 1st on the fiscal cliff. They did. You know, a paltry $60 billion in tax hikes on the wealthiest 0.7%. And then I predicted, there would be no government shutdown on March 27th, the next milestone. And, of course, there wasn't. And I'm predicting now there won't be a shutdown either on May 18th when the debt ceiling deal comes in. They'll extend the debt ceiling deal. Why are they in all this agreement now all of a sudden, you know? It appears in the press that Obama and the Republicans and the T-Publicans are, you know, fighting it out over how much to cut and so on and so forth, but not really. It's a well-orchestrated dance, and they've already come to an agreement, I believe, except in some trifle details. After all, you know, the target for 2.5 years of deficit cuts has been $4 trillion. That was the Simpson-Bowles target. They've already achieved $2.8 trillion of those $4 trillion. And by the way, it's been almost all spending cuts, just as the Republicans wanted. Obama's been caving in and caving in time and time again. And now he's caving in again. And he's already been saying, let's cut Medicare and Social Security. Well, that's how they'll come up with the other $1.2 trillion to get their $4 trillion. You're going to see a minimum of $600 billion in Medicare, Medicaid cuts. And my last comment on that, Obama's going after Medicare, just as the Republicans are going after Medicare. He's already said he's going to raise the COLA, or reduce the COLA on Social Security, introduce a means test, etc. They'll raise the retirement age for sure. As I've said, watch out for Medicare. They're going to make you pay more for what you got. More deductibles, more copays, so forth. That's how they're going to deal with $600 billion in Medicare. Watch it. And, you know, just yesterday, last comment here, then we're going to move on. Just yesterday, the Obama administration told the insurance, health insurance companies that they will approve an increase in payments to the insurance companies. Can you believe this? They're going to pay, Medicare is going to pay the insurance companies even more than it is? And that means they're going to have to make you, Mr. and Mrs. Medicare recipient, pay even more out of pocket so the health insurance companies can get their higher payments. You know, go figure it out, folks. All right. Enough of my weekly report on deficit spending. We'll continue that, of course. Next week, we're going to see Obama's budget come out on April 10th. We'll get a good picture what he's talking about in terms of cutting Social Security and Medicare. By the way, I do have a 35-minute presentation that is on my website as well on Social Security and Medicare cuts that are coming that I made to the Progressive Democrats of America in San Francisco last month. So if you want to see a pretty good summary, video summary, go to my website, Keep Close Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com. You can also access it from my blog, JackRasmus.com, and watch that. And note the predictions. Okay, let's get on to this important question of jobs. One of the biggest problems we've had and why we don't have a recovery that's really robust for Main Street here is this jobs problem. And the jobs problem is both cyclical. In other words, we're not really doing much to get jobs, good jobs, going here as a result of this recession. But we have a deeper, more fundamental structural problem of job creation going on in this country. And I believe it's largely attributable to free trade and incentives and subsidies to corporations to replace workers with new plant and equipment, new technology. Those two things are gutting the U.S. labor force and turning it into a contingent labor force, part-time, temporary, low-paid service jobs. And, of course, that means less income and less consumption and no recovery. And now Obama's running around trying to pass rapidly these free trade deals, free trade on steroids that will make NAFTA and China PNTR look like a dress rehearsal. And not only in the Pacific, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, but now they've opened up discussions on a Transatlantic Partnership Free Trade Agreement. So it's a double whammy coming. And they're moving very fast on this. And this is where Art Stamoulis comes in. Art is probably the expert on what is the status of this, the Citizens Trade Group, of which Art, I think, is executive director. Art, you can clarify that. And make sure you tell people where they can go to on the web and whatever to find out the latest on this and where they could get involved to protest this, too. But, Art, I'm going to open it up to you now, Art. Tell us, what's the latest going on with the TPP? Where are we at? What's happening?
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. So folks know the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is a massive new trade and investment pact that's being pushed behind closed doors by the Obama administration at the behest of some of the biggest transnational corporations in the world. There have been 16 major rounds of negotiations over a period of about 3 years. The last just wrapped up in Singapore a couple weeks ago. And they're racing to get this agreement done by this October.
By this October.
As you said, you know, it's currently under negotiation between the United States and 10 other countries throughout the Pacific Rim. So just among the countries currently at the table, this would be the largest free trade agreement ever in U.S. history. But the TPP is also specifically intended as a docking agreement, meaning that other countries throughout the world can dock on or join over time. And since the last time we spoke, Japan has just announced its intention to join the TPP. They're a massive economy.
Let me interrupt you. Japan, we run a huge trade deficit already with Japan every year to the tune of tens, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars. What are the industries that, if Japan is part of this agreement and it looks like it's imminent, What are the industries in the U.S. that can expect to really get hit hard as a result of TPP in general and TPP including Japan?
Well, clearly the auto industry and the auto parts sector, which is largely responsible for the middle class in the United States, and which, despite the hits it's taken over the years, still provides a lot of employment for people throughout the Midwest and other parts of the country, would take a massive hit if Japan enters this agreement without major changes to its shape and form. Throughout the pact, we've got countries like Vietnam at the table, which are specifically marketed as low-cost labor alternatives to China. The average minimum wage in Vietnam is a third of the minimum wage in China. And so Vietnam, Malaysia, other nations, are trying to grab a major part of the manufacturing share. Things that used to be made in the United States, now made in other countries, that they're looking to grab even more of that work. So virtually anyone in the manufacturing sector the AFL-CIO is predicting literally millions of U.S. jobs lost if this pact continues.
In manufacturing alone?
Or in general? Their predictions are broader, but certainly manufacturing is going to be the sector that's the hardest hit. But
we only have 8 million production jobs left in manufacturing.
This is going to gut a huge part of what we have left. And then increasingly we're seeing white-collar jobs shift overseas. Not only, call centers, but increasingly computer programming, software development, financial services positions, virtually any job that can be done over a phone or a computer can now be offshore, and we're seeing more and more of that. I live in Oregon, and traditionally the computer programming jobs that used to be done here in the Pacific Northwest would go to India, but now we're seeing more and more those jobs move to Vietnam, where companies can get even lower prices for computer programmers. So there are very few jobs that aren't vulnerable to offshoring, and even if you're in a position that is, difficult to offshore, you're still affected by the downward pressure on the wages and the benefits of the jobs that are left. The Economic Policy Institute came out with a study just about a week ago that put the average cost of offshoring to most U.S. households most U.S. individuals at $1,700 per year. And if you think of, a two-wage earner household, that's over $3,000 a year. That's real money out of our pockets each and every year going into the pockets of big corporations, big investors.
Folks want to look at that. That's EPI.org. Go to EPI.org and look at their trade sector there, and you'll be able to read what they're writing about. But go ahead, Art.
So a major part of this agreement, the TPP, is about, again, making it easier, even easier, for corporations to shift jobs throughout the globe to wherever working conditions are the most exploitative, wherever environmental regulations are the weakest, wherever they're going to get the most money possible. And so, 20 years ago, under NAFTA, we saw jobs moving from the U.S. to Mexico. Then when China entered the World Trade Organization, through a vote of the U.S. Congress, permanent normal trade relations with China, we saw a lot of jobs start moving to China. And now under the TPP, it's very easy to predict a lot of work moving from the United States to countries like Vietnam and Malaysia. It's called a global race to the bottom, and there's a reason for that. And each step of the way, each step in the process, working people get paid less and less money. And it's not consumers who pocket most of that difference. It's the middlemen. It's the corporations, the manufacturers, and the retailers who are eating that difference and funneling that money into the pockets of the 1%.
For listeners, they might note this following fact, and that is It's a critique of the free trade idea that says, everyone benefits from free trade, right? Everybody, we may lose some jobs here, but we'll gain jobs because we'll have more exports, even though we will lose out to imports. So, you know, all boats rise according with the free trade ideology idea, but that's not true. Look, this is the fact. This is studies that have been done by the government and some independent academics show that although we create some jobs from free trade, i.e. U.S. exports increase in some industries, we lose more jobs from imports as a result of free trade. Moreover, the jobs that we create from the new jobs from exports pay 20% less than the jobs that we lose from imports due to free trade. So we're not only losing jobs, but as you pointed out, the wage level is declining as we lose jobs. And that's one of the big problems why we can't get out of this recession, right? Average median family incomes are declining every year. They have been for 10 years, and now they're accelerating the decline. Consumers, 70% of the economy, can't seem to buy enough goods to get the economy going. And to the extent they do, they are buying on credit. Credit cards, once again, and or dissaving. They're taking money out of their 401ks and their savings accounts to maintain their general consumption. In fact, other studies show that over half of the income that's taken out of 401ks is just being used now to pay monthly bills. This isn't for education and medical and so forth, right? Buying houses. No, it's just to get by. So consumers, the mass of consumers, are spending on credit cards again and taking their savings because their income is falling, and their income is falling in large part because of this free trade thing and the decline of jobs and income. Ah, okay. There's just make a note of that, everybody. Okay, go ahead, Art. Continue.
Yeah, there's also a very clear correlation between the loss of manufacturing jobs and increases in state budget deficits. So you have these major manufacturers, major employers, either directly moving overseas or being displaced by competitors who are importing. You've got more and more people, you know, competing for fewer and fewer jobs, which is driving down wages and benefits for everyone. That reduces the tax base for revenue for our schools, for our roads and bridges, for other public services. And so the government itself has less money to spend, you know, buying more on credit. And, you know, we lose more jobs that way as well. I mean, I live in Oregon, when one of the major paper mills here, had been in operation for over 100 years, closed down in competition with imports from China. The local government, the city government, immediately started laying off workers because they knew they were going to bring in less money in fees and tax revenue, and they couldn't afford to pay people anymore. There are huge ripple effects, that affect everyone in a variety of ways.
Including education, right?
Because no, that's right.
Education publicly, but you know what? We don't need public education. Let's privatize education, as they say, right? Turn them all into charter schools, for-profit charter schools. Right?
Yeah, no. I mean, these are agreements that impact, you know, not only our livelihoods directly as adults, but our children's and our grandchildren's livelihoods. It's reducing the job opportunities for them in the future, but it's also reducing the money for our schools and their ability for folks to be trained for the next jobs, the jobs of the future. And, you know, again, I hear that term often, you know, 21st century jobs, but, you know, there's this attitude you'll sometimes encounter with members of Congress, like, we're losing manufacturing jobs. That's okay. We don't want to, you know, make things here in the United States anymore. We want to be, you know, training computer programmers and, you know, insurance salespeople and actuaries. And, you know, those are the jobs we want for our kids, the jobs of the future. Well, you know, it's completely wrong that manufacturing doesn't matter to the U.S. economy. We can get into that. But it's also wrong that you know, people in poor nations can't program computers. They can't answer phones. They can't sell insurance. They can't, you know, monitor stocks for us. You know, there are very few jobs that aren't vulnerable to offshoring. And this idea that, you know, just because it was the manufacturing jobs that went first, those are the only jobs that are affected, is absolutely incorrect.
Yeah, well, I think we've made the case that it's not just the direct loss of jobs. It impacts everything's connected economically, and, you know, it impacts everything, consumption and incomes and tax bases and services and so forth. And, you know, this free trade stuff is just gutting the American economy. It's just hollowing it out. And people, you know, it's going step by step. People don't see it. It's been... you know, here for 20, 25 years, and it's getting more intense and worse, and the U.S. economy is crumbling from the inside out in large part because of free trade. Tell us a little bit about where the negotiations are at present compared to 6 months ago.
Yeah, so as I said, they've just wrapped up the 16th major round, and one of the big things that came out of this round is that the United States is now giving in to other countries on issues they hadn't been before.
Like what?
Well, so for number one, the United States had been insisting that there be mandatory labor standards in the TPP. That, you know, they're not... From what we're able to tell, very strong standards. We don't believe that they'd be effective at protecting workers' rights abroad or jobs here at home. But they were were pushing for some basic labor standards in the agreement. The word out of the Singapore round is that they're now talking about a phase-in period for labor rights protections. That, okay, well, you know, we don't expect countries to, you know, be upholding basic human rights recognized under, under, you know, the ILO and other international standards. Right out of the gate, we're going to have a phase-in period. So that's one of the areas.
Yeah, in the meantime, we'll exempt 6 years old from making tennis shoes and sneakers, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, if you look at countries, you know, already in the TPP, you know, I've mentioned Vietnam, which the U.S. State Department noted, you know, has no legal way for having independent trade unions, you know, independent trade unions and even opposition political parties are illegal in Vietnam. You know, Brunei, which is one of the countries of the table, a monarchy, has virtually no union activity nor any legal basis for collective bargaining or strikes. Some of the other countries, you know, that are considerably better on paper, like Mexico, their maquiladoras are frequently controlled by company-run ghost unions insofar as there are any unions at all, so that there's a contract between the union and the company, but employees don't even know that they belong to a union. They're not seeing dues taken out. They're not, you know, they have no nobody representing them that they ever get to meet. You know, and a number of the
companies, unions, right.
Yeah, no, and a number of the countries, you know, the State Department says are known for using forced labor and child labor. So, so this is one of the areas where the U.S. is, you know, giving in by not requiring strong upfront labor standards, potentially. You know, one of the things I'll mention is that, you know, despite over 3 years and 16 major rounds of negotiations, the Obama administration still refuses to tell us what it's been proposing in our names. So what we know about the TPP comes not from our own government, but from a handful of leaked documents, which are published on our website, citizenstrade.org, and from conversations with negotiators from other countries. It's not coming from our own government being transparent. And this is a rollback in transparency, by the way, from even the Bush administration, which published draft text for the Free Trade Area of the Americas and often published proposals for the World Trade Organization.
You mean our government's not telling us the truth, Art?
I'm not telling anything, is what I'm telling you.
Not even anything, right?
Yeah,
they're
no.
Not even bothering to lie about it. They're just nothing, nada.
Yeah, and meanwhile, while you and I are, you know, the people who are going to be most affected by this agreement have no right to know what's being proposed in our name during the formative stages, they have granted about 600 corporate lobbyists access to the text, the special cleared advisors. So Walmart, Cargill, Chevron, they have access to the text. But, you know, I mean, to get back to your original question, they very clearly are racing to get this done as quickly as possible. And they're talking about October as their deadline. The heads of state are going to be meeting for an APEC meeting in Asia, and they want to be able to announce that they have an agreement at that meeting, and they're taking that deadline very seriously.
Let's hold that thought, and when we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about potential impact of this thing on environmental issues. But we need to take a little break now, and we'll come right back. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We're talking about the new free trade agreements, and we're also going to talk about the parallel agreement taking off with Europe. But let's take a break now and come back shortly. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which is on the very, very fast track. Looks like something's going to happen before the end of the year. Free trade has cost us already millions of jobs. How many million more will this cost? And then coming behind the TPP, we have the Transatlantic Partnership thing that's just beginning to get some traction as well. Art Stamoulis is Executive Director of Citizens Trade Campaign, is my guest today, and we're talking about this. Art, before we move on, where can people go to find out more about what the Citizens Trade Campaign is doing?
Yeah, you can visit our website at citizenstrade.org. So plural, citizenstrade, all one long word, .org.
Now, does that site also talk about where organized protests are being arranged? And
yeah, no, absolutely. People can visit that site for, you know, there's a giant take action button on the side. You can take action. You can download our organizer's toolkit about the TPP for more, you know, more ways to get involved locally. And I'll also mention that there are planned International Days of Action on the TPP coming up for May 11th. There's not a lot of information on our website about that yet, but if you sign up for an email list there, you'll get the information. You could also visit an international website called tppxborder.org for more.
Say that again, tppxborder? Letter X or EX?
That's great. The letter X, tppxborder.org, standing for cross border.
Okay.
There's information on the May 11th Day of Action that's starting to be posted there.
Okay. As you know, folks, this show, it's not enough to simply gripe and complain and talk about the dimensions of the growing problem. It's time to do something about it. So get out there. If you feel you know, concerned about this issue, if you think your job is the next target, that it probably is, since this thing is so broad and comprehensive, then get out there and do something. You know, something. Get off your butt. Okay, let's get back to the question I left right before we took a break, Art. And quickly, what's going to be the environmental impact? Are there any estimates of what free trade is going to further do environmentally, particularly in the Pacific Rim countries?
Yeah, so one of the leaked documents from the TPP negotiations that you can find on our website, citizenstrade.org, shows that the U.S. Is pushing for the TPP to include what's called investor-to-state dispute resolution. And so that's a provision that would grant transnational corporations the power to challenge virtually any new environmental or consumer safety law, regulation, or even court decision that negatively affects their expectation of profits.
Wow.
They challenge it as a regulatory taking. It's not heard through the U.S. court system or any other country's domestic judicial system, but rather through private tribunals that circumvent judicial systems. There's a variety of places they can be housed. It's often at the World Bank. And these tribunals are set up with a panel of three judges who are picked from a pool of primarily corporate trade attorneys, people who work for big corporations for a large part of their income, and then they're empowered to grant unlimited taxpayer damages, taxpayer compensation to these allegedly aggrieved corporations for, you know, indirect expropriation. I had to pay, you know, there was a new environmental law imposed. I had to pay money to meet that law. You need to compensate me for that. And so, you know, right now under the World Trade Organization, which allows for state-to-state dispute resolution where governments can challenge each other's policies, the United States has already lost more than 90% of the over 65 cases brought against it. So portions of the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act have been rolled back. We've seen, you know, country of origin labeling, tobacco controls attacked into the system. The TPP would go even beyond the World Trade Organization, again, by giving individual corporations the power to initiate those challenges. You know, and I'll say right now, you know, there are a number of smaller free trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties that grant corporations the power to access this, you know, essentially an alternative system of justice set up just for transnational capital. And they're being used to attack clean air rules in Peru, mining laws in El Salvador, a court decision against the oil giant Chevron in Ecuador, among many other examples. The TPP would expand this system throughout the Pacific Rim, so it's going to increase the attacks on developing countries' environmental laws, and it's also going to give, you know, new corporations in countries like Japan now the power to attack U.S. laws. So this is, you know, expected to have a major impact on environmental regulation in the future, and that's why, you know, groups like
Sierra Club. It sounds to me like we ought to just disband the Environmental Protection Agency because corporations, if we sign this agreement, corporations can pretty much negate whatever it wants to do. You know, and it sounds it sounds like a big problem, as I see it, with this whole gas fracking movement in the United States. In other words, the whole question is how fast to move on gas, natural gas fracking. Do we do it just for U.S. Consumption, or do we do it for exports? So I know, and you might comment on this, Japan is very much focused on natural gas and would import an awful lot from the United States. So is it realistic to assume that if we have this agreement and Japan's part of this TPP, that U.S. corporations that want to accelerate gas fracking here in the United States in order to export to Japan would pretty much be able to say, okay, EPA, sorry, your rules have nothing to do with our profits?
No, absolutely. I'm already under NAFTA. We've got a case where a Texas-based company involved with fracking has used a similar investor-to-state tribunal system to challenge Quebec's fracking ban or fracking moratorium in Quebec, and this would empower even more corporations throughout the Pacific Rim to have access to that. But even more than that, just under U.S. domestic law, the U.S. Natural Gas Act has a provision that requires most natural gas export projects to undergo economic and environmental review. But it's got a clause in there that says if we have a free trade agreement with the country where the gas would be exported, that project is automatically deemed in the public interest and that economic and environmental review is bypassed. So
wow.
Japan is the largest importer of natural gas in the world. The natural gas prices in Japan are almost $17 per million metric BTU compared with less than $3 for the same unit in New York. You know, the energy companies are salivating to sell U.S. natural gas.
Sounds like when they legislated that gas act, they had an eye on these free trade agreements as a way of pretty much opening up big loopholes in the gas act.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. You know, there was a lot of obfuscation in the past around natural gas and talking about imports and our need to import natural gas imports as well, but now with the fracking rush, it's very much about exporting, which, you know, obviously increases prices for U.S. employers and U.S. consumers and, you know, and reduces manufacturing costs in other countries. So this will have a huge impact on fracking, for sure.
Which countries look like the early signatories to this agreement coming in this October?
Yeah, so right now, already at the table are the U.S., Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. As I mentioned, Japan has just announced their plans to join. And since Japan has come out, you've got the Philippines, Thailand, other countries expressing interest. I mean, Indonesia, there's even been some talk about Taiwan, Colombia, you know, a number, or, you know, want in on the game. And the idea with this is largely has been to set the rules of the game with a limited number of countries. And then, you know, to say, hey, if you want in too, if you want access to all these markets, you need to accept all the radical deregulation provisions in this agreement. You know, this is a pact that's set at 29 separate chapters. You know, a number of them deal directly with trade and cross-border trade and goods and services. But a lot of them have things, you know, cover things that we wouldn't traditionally consider trade policy. So there's a financial services chapter that deals with banking regulation. There's a sanitary and phytosanitary chapter that deals with food safety regulation. There's a chapter on government procurement, so how are governments allowed to spend taxpayer funds and make decisions on, you know, how they're going to prioritize the use of taxpayer dollars for local development. You know, this is a very far-reaching agreement, and I think, you know, it could adequately, you know, very accurately be called a corporate rights agreement.
It's an early stage of corporate political and government control, corporate sovereignty, let's say, multinational, big corporate sovereignty, because, you know, it's at the cost of our own legislation, our own sovereignty. So, you know, is this the 21st century corporate takeover of the world latest early move? It's worth thinking about, I would say.
It's definitely a corporate power grab, and it's definitely, you know, not only about making it easier to shift jobs throughout the world, but also about putting checks on democracy, both at home and abroad, by, you know, really constraining communities' ability to adopt new public interest regulations and giving corporations new tools that, you know, citizens don't have access to, domestic businesses don't have access to, just transnational investors, transnational corporations, to attack our, you know, again, not only our laws and regulations, but our court decisions.
Yes. Okay. I want you to hold that thought. When we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about the parallel development now beginning also to get off the ground, the Transatlantic Partnership. Tell us a little bit about that, but let's take a break, our last break real quickly. Alternative Visions, be back in a minute.
You make it new. If I had me a gun, I'd find the bastards and shoot them on sight. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright. I'm a jack of all trades.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
It's the VRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul.
Sweet a soul.
And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN.FM. Giving you a daily progressive take on the world.
Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, the topic, the free trade agreements on a global scale rapidly taking shape here. And where we left at the beginning of the last break was I had asked our guest, Art Stimulus, to consider saying a few things on the parallel development, the transatlantic partnership to the TPP, the Pacific Partnership Agreement. This was a more recent development here. Obama, who is, of course, totally committed to free trade and the TPP, and is running around Europe, running around the Pacific countries, I believe, in a tour right now, lining up some of these players, announced during his State of the Union address that he wanted to also negotiate a new free trade agreement with the Eurozone and the European Union. And to complete that within 2 years. Okay, and Eurozone and Europe is in a real bad shape. Unemployment's 12%, rising. They are slowly slipping into a deeper and deeper recession there, and can't create jobs, just like in the U.S. We're having a hard time creating jobs. So is this TAP, let's call it, in Europe, an attempt to have a second track in which the U.S. and Europe protect themselves from Asia, let's say China? And to what extent, too, is the TPP a political move to box in China? I guess that's a double question, Art, if you want to say a few things about the TAP, and then, what's the Obama pivot here, as it's called, to Asia-Pacific have to do with all this in China?
Yeah, so in terms of the EU free trade agreement, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, clearly a lot of European countries have been jealous, for lack of a better word, or feeling left out by Obama's Asian pivot, and have been pushing for a free trade agreement for a while. And as you mentioned, President Obama just in the State of the Union announced that his administration will be pushing forward for a new free trade agreement, very much in the formative stages, not anywhere near as far down the road as the TPP. And we evaluate those agreements the same as we do any agreement. Is this going to contribute to a more just and sustainable global economy, or is it going to do the opposite? The jobs impacts of a European free trade agreement still need to be seen. I mean, clearly, there aren't as egregious human rights abuses in Europe of labor as there are in countries like Vietnam and Brunei and Malaysia. That said, it's very clear Wall Street wants to use a European agreement to further deregulate the financial sector. Big Ag wants to use a European free trade agreement to further put caps and limits on food safety standards and consumer rights standards. And so we have to look at what are the deregulatory impacts of this? What are the impacts on environmental regulation? And that remains to be seen. It's an issue that people are going to be fighting over for a number of years. Frankly, I have little confidence that a European free trade agreement is going to be any different from what we've seen the administration pushing with the TPP and with past free trade agreements. In terms of China, absolutely all these agreements are part of a larger strategy to pressure China to get with the program and to accept U.S. demands for deregulation of its industry, to accept more privatization, more liberalization of its markets. And China is feeling very left out of the TPP, and I think there's a clear reason for that. The United States has repeatedly said China will be welcome at the table if they accept the quote-unquote high standards that the U.S. is demanding, and I think that's true. And this is an attempt to pressure China and other countries to accept the deregulation, to accept the privatization, to accept the trade liberalization that Wall Street and K Street and big business in the U.S. have been pushing for many years now.
Wasn't China in the process of trying to form its own free trade zone there in Asia with some of the countries in Asia? And therefore, TPP could be seen in part as a attempt to head that off?
Yeah, no, China has been pushing the ASEAN, the trade region. This is in many ways a parallel agreement, so some countries that are involved with that are also involved with the TPP. But theirs is, a far less ambitious program in terms of what they're requiring of countries to join. There's, frankly, has a lot more to do with trade, per se. This has a lot to do with trade, but also a lot to do with, as I said, banking and food safety and, government procurement, you name it.
Are there any negotiations underway for the transatlantic partnership, or is it just an announcement thing here in the last few months?
So far it's just an announcement. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative just this week published, in the Federal Register that they're intending to move forward with this. And there's actually a public comment period where, people can comment broadly on what they would want or not want in a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. That comment period closes May 10th, I believe, and then the negotiations presumably would start shortly thereafter. But already the USTR has indicated that they're going to require investor state dispute resolution process of this, and that they're going to push Europe to roll back a lot of its food safety standards, which are stronger in a lot of ways than what we have here in the U.S.
Yeah, it seems to me that General Electric and Jeff Immelt are in the driver's seat here. I mean, this has been their priority since Obama put them in charge of the jobs program at the end of 2010, and it looks like they're getting pretty much, whatever they want here. If Obama would only deal with the 14 million foreclosed homeowners and the 20 million still without jobs as vigorously as he's dealing with free trade, maybe we would see some further developments of a positive nature here in the U.S. economy. But, of course, that's not the case. Tell us where people can go to find out what CitizensTrade.org and your group is doing and what's upcoming in terms of action here. I want to get that in one more time before the end of the show here. So tell us.
Yeah, no, thank you. Please visit our website, CitizensTrade.org. There's a big take action button right on the right-hand side of the page. There's also a place where you can sign up for our email list. And we don't bomb you. We don't trade the list. We're gonna give you updates on how to take action in timely and important ways. And as you know, if you're someone who wants to get more involved, you can download our organizer toolkit, which has talking points, fact sheets, information on how to organize events, write letters to the editor, petition, pass templates, pass resolutions in any organizations you may be involved with, as well as local points of contact throughout the country.
Talking about taking action, we didn't discuss briefly in what remains a minute or so here. What's the AFL-CIO doing in terms of taking action? I know they've been saying things, talking the talk, but, in so many cases, the talk-to-talk doesn't result in walk-to-walk. So what's the AFL-CIO doing?
Well, their executive council just passed published a fantastic statement about the TPP, which is a very important, first step. A number of their affiliates have been using the spring recess to do workshops with their members about the TPP and then mobilize them to collect postcards about it, to meet with members of Congress, to make phone calls, do action alerts, which is great, which is what it takes. I mean, what we really need people to do at this point in the negotiations, when it's so close to done, is to contact their members of Congress and say no to fast-track for the TPP, that we do not want them to approve fast-tracking the trade agreement.
Well, let me throw a difficult question out to you, though. Do you really think, with Obama pushing so hard, that the Democrats, at least the majority of them, not the progressive wing, that's a very small group now, aren't going to support Obama and go forward with this?
We got over two-thirds of the Democrats to oppose Obama on the Korea Free Trade Agreement, and I think even more people are paying attention to the TPP. So I think, it's going to take people working and demanding it. Without that, we're definitely going to lose.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Art. We're going to have you back as this thing develops later in the year. But this is Alternative Visions, and next week I will start my several-week sequence evaluation and predictions on the U.S. economy. So stay tuned for the jobs picture next Wednesday. Alternative Visions.